This podcast was recorded at the 2018 JADPRO Live at AppShow Conference in Hollywood, Florida. To review the CE information and learn how to earn credit for JADPRO Live podcast activities, see the presentation material, or seek other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from JADPRO Live.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for being here. My name is Gabrielle Zaisha. I am a PA at the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. Our next session is entitled New Directions in Myeloid Malignancies, and it is my pleasure and honor to introduce two of the most fantastic people who are incredibly knowledgeable about AML and myeloid malignancies, Ms. Kelda Gardner and Melinda Tran. Come on up.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
I'm Kelda.
And I'm Melinda.
There have been a number of updates and changes over the last couple of years. And we have a couple of learning objectives we'll start with. We're going to talk about outline strategies to monitor MRD. It's noted on the slide to be minimal residual disease. At our center, we often call it measurable residual disease, because in the eyes of the patient, any leftover leukemia or blood disorder is not really thought to be minimal for them, so we call it measurable residual disease. And then we'll look at some novel approaches, including safety and efficacy, and then also describe a number of mechanisms of actions of targeted agents. Neither of us have anything to disclose financially. And then just another little deeper outline, we're going to talk just very quickly about epidemiology. There have been some changes in risk classification we'll talk about. I feel anytime you talk about hematologic disorders, especially high-grade ones, it's important to talk about heme emergencies. There's just three slides on that, so not too much. And then response criteria has changed in the last couple of years. And then we'll talk about MRD relapse, and then therapies, new drugs, and then we'll end with a little information about APL. You've all seen this probably many, many times, either in your training or in your clinics, in the patient rooms. As the main attending I work with, Eli SD, likes to say pretty frequently, blasts don't come from the sky, they actually come from the bone marrow. So it all starts right here inside the bone. You develop a hematopoietic stem cell, and as that grows, it eventually divides out into being a myeloid lineage or a lymphoid lineage, and what we're going to talk about is far on the right with the myeloid. Acute leukemia can present in the marrow. It can show up in the blood, and it also can be seen in organs. Or even as a mass outside of the blood and marrow system. And that would be called a granulocytic sarcoma. There are a number of clonal blood disorders with myeloid phenotypes. And this is a pretty good schematic, I think, that shows a whole list of these and how they can all actually develop into acute leukemia. Estimated in 2018, there'll be about 20,000 new cases of AML, estimated deaths about 10,000, and a five-year survival rate of only about 27%, which is still pretty low in the world of oncology. It has improved over time from 6.3% in 1975. A lot of that has to do with supportive care, and we'll talk about regimens that have been used over the last 40-plus years and how we're just now seeing emergence of new therapies. And the median age of diagnosis is 68. The incidence of AML goes up with age. Overall, about 4 cases in 100,000 patients. Etiology is generally mostly unknown. The two most important characteristics are listed in bold here. Prior chemotherapy or radiation, also known as TAML for treatment-related AML, or secondary AML, from having a prior hematologic disorder. There are two survival graphs. The one on the left is all patients with de novo with either secondary AML treatment-related AML, and there's a striking difference between that and the one on the right, which shows a survival curve of patients with a favorable type risk de novo AML. There's been a lot learned in the last couple of decades about genetic predisposition to AML, and it's expected, they're thought to be about 5 to 10% of these patients have some sort of an inherited background. So the, one of the big questions is who to test and who to look for genetic predispositions. And in our center, we're really looking and testing patients that are under the age of 45 or that have a strong family history of AML or MDS. Diagnosis of AML is by WHO criteria, 20% more myeloid blasts that are in the marrow, or sometimes you can just do it off peripheral blood if there's enough blasts in the peripheral blood. With the diagnosis of AML comes the pretreatment knowledge that outcomes range from death within a few days of starting therapy to a potential cure. So there's mandatory testing, at least at our center, that we consider doing at diagnosis, morphology, obviously, cytogenetics, FISH, molecular studies, either by a hotspot or next generation sequencing, and also immunophenotyping, flow cytometry. And the importance of doing the full panel workup at the initial diagnosis is not only does it give a prognostic indication it for potential needing a transplant or novel therapies, and also it gives us an idea of what markers we'd like to follow later to see if someone's really truly in a CR and how they responded to therapy. So as we move into cytogenetic abnormalities in AML, it's pretty overwhelming to distinguish from the variety of different abnormalities, what would be considered a good marker or what would be considered a bad marker. You can see from the slide that most patients show up with a normal karyotype. And as this is a disease of older patients, the older someone is, the more likely they are to have abnormalities with cytogenetics as we're regrowing them all the time. And by the age of 70, about 10% presumed normal people, not people with AML, but just normal people walking around, will have mutations in the hematopoietic cells. This is one of my favorite slides. I think it's very pretty.
It's really pretty.
Melinda and I would like to get a scarf made out of this.
We should have done that.
Would have been good. This is a nice show of molecular abnormalities and just how tremendously heterogeneous the population is in regards to molecular. There is a lot of co-localization that happens, as for instance, you can see on this, NPM1 positive patients can also be a FLT3 positive, have FLT3 positive markers. This is from some ECOG data that looked at survival of hundreds of patients and their mutations. Last year, the ELN, European Leukemia Network, came up with a new set of risk classification. This is a bit messy slide, but it's a good demonstration of what actually has changed. In 2010 was the first year that they put together cytogenetics and molecular together to do risk stratification, and that continued in the redo in 2017, with the main changes being that intermediate 1 and intermediate 2 were combined. And then also it adds in the TP53 abnormality, which we know is the single most adverse factor. And it also divides out patients that are FLT3 by their allelic ratios. Here's just a quick diagram of the survival stratification by ELN. The one on the left-hand side is the new one with 2017, which has intermediate combined. And the one on the right is from 2010 that has the intermediate divided out. Just a couple words on heme malignancies. Leukocytosis Hyperleukocytosis defined as a white cell count of over 100,000. Leukostasis is the concern, and it usually affects the CNS and the lungs, which is the most concerning. The main treatment is cytoreduction with the use of Hydrea and or dexamethasone for pulmonary symptoms, high-dose ARA-C, one dose or two doses, and also leukapheresis. Everybody really wants to know what the exact number is or the ideal number is to actually initiate cytoreduction. And really one of the main things is to look for symptoms like stroke-like symptoms, blurred vision, and whatnot to initiate intervention. The symptoms may tell you a bit more than the actual total white cell count. Mm-hmm. Tumor lysis syndrome, probably more common in ALL and lymphomas, but certainly can be seen in the myeloid malignancies as well. It can be spontaneous or chemo-induced, and also you can see hyperkalemia, hyperphosphatemia, and hypocalcemia. Hydration is one of the main stones of treating this, and at least with the AML population, we have to be a bit judicious with fluids, given the chance for it rushing to the lungs and causing pulmonary insufficiency. Next up is hemorrhagic syndrome, very common in APL patients, and we're going to talk about that right towards the end. The big things with this are keeping platelets up, transfusing FFP to keep an INR up to above 1.5, and then cryo to keep a fibrinogen well above 150. Who here has heard about the treatment-related mortality online scoring system? Anybody?
A few. We've seen, yeah.
So Dr. Roland Walter and Eli Esty came up with this treatment-related mortality calculator, which looks at a number of different variables for a newly diagnosed AML patient and the chances of dying within 28 days of receiving intensive chemotherapy. It looks at age, platelets, albumin, whether they have secondary AML or primary AML, white cell count, peripheral blood blasts, and a creatinine. You can just Google TRM calculator FHCRC, which is Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center, and it'll just take you to this calculator and you can start putting in numbers. This is just a picture of it. You just put in all of the different variables and then you get the TRM at the bottom. And this, for this patient, the likelihood of dying is about 11% within the first month of starting chemotherapy. All right, another update that's happened in the last couple of years is that ELN also has updated the response criteria. There's a new category that's been added, which is the one on the top. It's bolded, it's CR without MRD. And in the CR category, you'll see under the comment section on the right that this also now includes whether someone has MRD positive or it's unknown if they are MRD positive. The CRI now encompasses CRP, so whether someone hasn't recovered their neutrophils or haven't recovered their platelet count, either way, they get put into the CRI category. So speaking of CRIs or CRPs or MRD, there's a lot of interest right now about what to do about measurable residual disease and the importance of the depth of response that a patient gets after therapy. Dr. Chen, a couple of years ago at Fred Hutch, did a retrospective analysis of several hundred patients, showing that blood count recovery is also important for response and survival. Just less than 5% blast in the blood is not alone sufficient, and CRPs and CRIs are inferior responses compared to a full CR. Now we'll move into measurable residual disease. Just as a CRP or CRI are inferior responses, so is the presence of residual disease. The survival curve, the one on the left, shows the chance of relapse when there's MRD, and the chart on the right shows overall survival. So with the one on the left, there's lower incidence of relapse without MRD, and then the chart on the right showing there's overall survival is better without MRD. Pathology has gotten more and more sophisticated. We have the multi-parameter flow cytometry testing to look for MRD. We also have the next generation sequencing looking at molecular studies. And this is a nice diagram that just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine this year, showing that if someone has flow cytometry or mutational testing that's positive or negative, how that affects the chance of relapse. So if you look at the top line, which is the purple line, those are patients that have both their disease that's positive by flow and positive by next generation sequencing, and they have the highest relapse rate of 75%. The patient in the group in the bottom, that's the blue lines, shows that if someone who has a negative flow cytometry and a negative molecular studies, showing a lower chance of relapse at about 25%. So the question remains what to do about MRD. Outcomes are clearly worse. A lot of clinical trials do not allow patients to get the different study drugs with only 2% or 3% blasts. And we certainly need more novel therapies, which we'll talk about a little bit later. I think it's pretty well known that the main reason that patients aren't cured from AML is because of resistance to disease, which can manifest as a relapse after remission. This shows the role of transplant after someone has relapsed if they didn't have a transplant in CR1. And for those with a favorable risk group, after an allo, they have an 88% five-year survival versus 33% without getting a transplant in the CR2. Get ready, you're gonna be up soon.
Oof.
Let's see, so older, actually one more slide. So patients that are older with AML, which is a good number of people that present, the question is age just a number? Medicare records from 2000 to 2009 showed that only about 40% of patients that were over the age of 65 received any type of chemotherapy within 3 months of their diagnosis. Also in this data set, it showed that patients that were actually treated lived longer. So the question is, what do you do with an older patient with AML? The ELN 2017 guidelines say that no longer should just age be a reason not to treat a patient with older ages, but it really should be age plus another factor against having an intensive therapy. So those things could be ECOG, such as 3 and 4, and other comorbidities. Okay. Next, we're going to start talking about therapy and new drugs. Just as a reminder, our backbone that's been the standard of care is 7 and 3, which is Ara-C and an anthracycline. And this, you'll see that the notation on the bottom cites a paper from 1973. That tells you a lot about really how far we've gone if our main backbone is still something from back then. The NCCN guidelines do recommend the best management for any cancer patient is on a clinical trial. A number of centers use 7 and 3. I know MD Anderson and some other places use a combination like FLAG-IDA. At our center, we use something very similar to FLAG-IDA. It's called G-CLAM with its cladribine. Ara-C and mitoxantrone. And that takes us to the concept of alternatives to intensive regimens, and Melinda's going to talk about that.
Oh, sheesh. Thanks so much, Kelda. I know Dr. Nelson and Dr. May will be presenting an update on new drugs and heme malignancies. So I'll kind of give you an idea of kind of the background of some of these drugs, the mechanism, but I won't go into too much detail about them just because there's going to be an excellent session coming up at 11:20 today. The drugs that are bolded are the ones that I'm going to be talking about today. And you'll hear, you'll see, Kelda, I'm going to be pointing to you, you know, for some commentary, just given your extensive background with AML and the research that's been and the different trials that, you know, our center has been through. Now, the first drug I'll talk about is formerly known as CPX-351, or liposomal donorubicin and cytarabine. When I was in the pharmacy, we'd call it Purple Rain, because if you've ever seen it, it's this 500 ml bag of just very beautiful violet color. So my technicians would call it a Purple Rain. But this is just a repackage of our traditional induction therapy of 3+7. It uses a liposomal fixed molar ratio of cytarabine and donorubicin. It utilizes this nanoscale delivery technology that seems to be preferentially taken in by the leukemic cells. So that hypothetically increases the efficacy while decreasing the toxicities. In a lot of our older patients, giving them 7+3 is almost as toxic as it is beneficial. So by formulating in this kind of repackaged liposomal formulation, we're hopefully decreasing that tissue distribution, that toxicity, and hopefully providing the same therapeutic benefit. And so this drug was approved in August 2017 based on the data from this phase 3 trial, where they randomized previously untreated high-risk AML patients, older patients, and the study had defined high-risk as patients with therapy-related AML, patients with previously with MDS or CMML, or de novo AML with MDS karyotypes. And so these patients were randomized to receive either donorubicin, standard 7+3, or the CPX-351. And so what we see is that what the CPX is superior to 7+3 in all endpoints that they examine. So overall survival, event-free survival, as well as response rate analyzed by CR and CRI. It also had a better 60-day mortality rate as well. One of the key takeaways from this study is that patients who received CPX were more likely to undergo a successful allotransplant than patients who underwent 7+3. And among those patients who underwent a successful allotransplant, those patients on CPX had a better median overall survival. It wasn't reached by the end of analysis, versus 10.25 months in patients who were on 7+3. I think one of the key things that I think about is that, hey, maybe this is a viable option for patients who have high-risk AML and are treatment transplant eligible. There we go. Now, when this drug first came out, there was a lot of concern about whether or not it would have increased toxicity. Because essentially, with this liposomal form, we are concerned that there's going to be a longer half-life of this drug. And indeed, there is a longer half-life. But what we know now is that the safety profile of this drug is very comparable to standard therapy. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, it had an improved 60-day mortality rate compared to 7+3. So I think it was like 13% versus 21% around there. There are some notable differences to CPX versus 7+3. The first one being that CPX had prolonged neutropenia and thrombocytopenia, so about 7 to 10 days longer than standard therapy. And then there was also increased risk of hemorrhagic and infectious adverse effects. But fortunately, those adverse effects did not result in increased risk of early mortality. Okay. So the next drug I'll talk about is gemtuzumab. And this one has a very long and unusual history. This was the first antibody drug conjugate approved for human use by the FDA. And we'll talk about the history in just a little bit, but just in a nutshell, it was approved in 2000, it was removed from the market in 2010, and then it makes a big comeback in 2017. It's a humanized monoclonal antibody, but you already knew that from the name, ZU humanized MAB monoclonal antibody, and it's conjugated to a toxin calicheamycin. It targets the transmembrane protein CD33 that is highly expressed on leukemic blast surfaces, and it affects, I believe, more than 80% of patients with AML express CD33. Some of the notable adverse effects include prolonged cytopenia, as well as VOD, veno-occlusive disease, which we'll talk about in just a little bit as well. As I'd mentioned, it's a monoclonal antibody. It binds to CD33 receptors. Once it binds to CD33, it's internalized into the cell. And under the acidic environment of the lysosome, the clytromycin gets cleaved. That gets released into the cell. That causes DNA, that binds to the DNA and causes double-strand, single-strand breaks, and eventually apoptosis. Now, when this drug was first approved in 2000, it was approved based on data from an accelerated interim analysis. And at that time, it was approved at the dose of 9 milligrams per meter squared on days 1 and 14, and it had a CR plus P of about 30%. Now, as part of the post-approval commitment, the drug manufacturers worked with SWOG on S0106, where they randomized over 600 patients with de novo AML, older patients, to receive either standard 7+3 plus or minus trastuzumab. But unfortunately, what they found was that there was no overall improvement in survival, and there was actually an increased risk of mortality in the experimental arm. And I know, Kelda, we worked on that trial, didn't we?
We sure did.
Yeah. Was there anything special about that trial that you remember?
Maybe not so much specifically about the SWOG 106, but maybe in the time after it was, gemtuzumab was taken off the market and went back on, but we can talk about that.
Okay, great. Now, this drug, like I said, it made its big comeback last year, and that was approval was based on a few different things. The first thing was, of course, the data from the Alpha 701 trial, also a better understanding of how we dose gemtuzumab, as well as just a lot of clinical experience, just as Kelda had mentioned. Just because it was off the market in 2010 doesn't mean we stopped using it. We've been using it ever since then. So there's just a lot of clinical experience behind that as well. Now, Alpha 701, very similar to the SWOG trial in that we randomized patients to either standard therapy plus or minus gemtuzumab. But what we did was that we used a lower dose. So instead of the 6 milligrams per meter squared used in the SWOG trial on day 4, we used 3 milligrams per meter squared on days 1, 4, and 7, I think. I forget. And when I say we, I wasn't part of this. I'm just we as a collective we. And what we found out was that patients who received gemtuzumab had a similar CR rate compared to the standard arm, but there was actually an improved relapse rate, so there was a reduced relapse rate. There was improved relapse-free as well as overall survival at 5 years. The other thing we learned, I had mentioned earlier, is that gemtuzumab, that VOD, is really associated with high max concentrations on the first dose. So by using a lower dose, there's actually, we would expect a lower concentration. And what we also know is that at the lower dose, the CR rate is comparable to the higher dose as well. In that meta-analysis that I just skipped, sorry about that, there was a meta-analysis that included that SWOG trial as well as the Alpha trial and 3 other randomized trial. It came out with similar findings as well. So same CR, but improved other outcomes. And from that meta-analysis, we see 3 survival curves. And each of these survival curves are for the different risk factors. So first one is for the favorable risk AML, second is for intermediate risk, and then the third one is for the adverse risk. And as you can expect, patients with favorable risk AML had the best outcomes with gemtuzumab. Mm-hmm. Okay. The next drug we'll talk about are IDH or isocitrate dehydrogenase mutations. And these mutations are found in 15 to 20% of newly diagnosed AML. They generally happen in older patients. They're generally associated with worse outcomes. And in normal cells, IDH converts isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate, or alpha-KG. And we'll talk a little bit more about what alpha-KG does in the body, but it's very important. But in mutant cells, the mutant IDH takes it one step further, and it converts alpha-KG to alpha-HG, or alpha-hydroxyglutarate, which is an oncometabolite. And this is the visual of what I just mentioned. So isocitrate is converted to alpha-KG by IDH 1 and 2. And as a throwback to our biochem days, you know, alpha-ketoglutarate is very important because you know, it's a key intermediate of the Krebs cycle. It also does a lot of different things to cellular processes. It helps break down or helps oxidize different nutrients, amino acids, glucose, fatty acids. It acts as an antioxidant and nitrogen scavenger, so it does a lot of different things in our system. From there, a mutant IDH will then convert it to 2-HG, an oncometabolite. And 2-HG's whole purpose in life is to promote leukemic proliferation. It blocks myeloproliferation, and it does it in a lot of different ways, but you know, I won't go too much into it other than the fact that it causes epigenetic changes, which somehow helps, forces the cell to lose the ability to differentiate correctly. Again, like I said, I won't talk too much about the drug itself just because there's an excellent session coming up in just a few hours. But inositinib is previously known as AG221, and this drug was approved in 2017. It's the first IDH inhibitor that was approved by the FDA. It targets IDH2. From what I know, this drug is fairly well tolerated. But one of the key things about this is differentiation syndrome. So anytime you have drugs that that promote differentiation, like things like ATRA or ATO, this drug, the next drug, we're going to be concerned about differentiation syndrome. So patients might experience some symptoms like acute respiratory distress, lymphedema, peripheral edema, pleural effusions, pericardial effusions, weight gain, leukocytosis, different things like that that you already know about. Very, very dangerous. And so we would have to treat this patient with the course of steroids until those symptoms have resolved. And depending on how severe those symptoms are, determines whether or not you would stop the drug in the interim. And of course, as a pharmacist, you know, I'm gonna be worried and concerned about drug interactions. This drug and its metabolite are processed by a number of CYPs as well as UGT, so please be aware of drug interactions. Ivosidenib, this one is previously known as AG120, very, very similar in that it is an IDH inhibitor, but it inhibits IDH1 enzyme. Also fairly well tolerated, differentiation syndrome is a concern, and it's primarily metabolized by CYP3A4, so drug interactions. Okay. Now, I won't go too much into each of the trials, but essentially both agents were studied in patients with relapsed refractory AML who had an IDH mutation, and the primary endpoint was overall response, so the CR plus CRH. What we see here is that both drugs were able to produce a clinically meaningful response that was also quite durable as well, so 8.2 months for each of these drugs. Okay. So moving on to BCL2 inhibitors. Resistance of apoptosis is really a hallmark of cancer biology. Pretty much all cancer cells are going to adopt some sort of mechanisms to avoid apoptosis, and leukemic cells are no exception. And AML cells happen to be very dependent on BCL2 for survival. And BCL2, if you remember, is a family of proteins, and think of it as a gatekeeper to apoptosis, and we'll talk a little bit more in the next slide. But they're very dependent on BCL2, which happens to also be increased in concentration in these leukemic cells. BCL2, there's a BCL2 protein, family of protein, but there's also a BCL2 protein itself, and it is an anti-apoptotic protein. Since we just talked about IDH mutations, I'll just kind of throw in a tidbit in there that patients, what we know is that some patients with a mutated IDH are more likely to respond to BCL2 inhibition. And then we'll talk about two clinical trials very, very quickly that involve the use of a BCL2 inhibitor plus a low-dose Ara-C or a hypomethylating agent. Now, as I mentioned, apoptosis is a hallmark of cancer. Resistance of apoptosis is a hallmark of cancer biology. And there's different pathways of apoptosis. There's an extrinsic pathway, which essentially something binds onto the cell, like a death receptor, and that causes the cell to kill itself. And then there's an intrinsic pathway, or the mitochondrial pathway, and that's where the cell will kill itself based on something it senses in the environment. And so typically in hemolymphocytes, there is a discrepancy or a dysregulation of intrinsic pathway. I'd also mention that BCL2 is a family of proteins. It considered as a gatekeeper to apoptosis. And that family of protein contains both pro-apoptotic as well as anti-apoptotic proteins. And when you have more of one or the other, then that shifts the balance between cell survival and cell death. Usually anti-apoptotic proteins and pro-apoptotic proteins, they live in homeostasis. They're in harmony, they're bound to each other, they cancel each other out. But in malignancies, you'll see a shifted one way. You'll see an increase of the anti-apoptotic stuff. And then that will shift it more into a cell survival mode. So drugs like venetoclax will actually displace the pro-apoptotic protein from the BCL protein and allow it to move on its merry way, fulfill its life, live its best life, and initiate apoptosis. Now, in this clinical trial, as well as the next one, we're utilizing venetoclax, the BCL2 inhibitor, in a combination with a hypomethylating agent, such as decitabine or azacitidine, in patients, typically in our older patients, who are not eligible for more intensive therapy. And I know this is also one that we did as well, this one as well as the next one. And what we saw in these trials is that patients who received this combination of venetoclax as well as a hypomethylating agent, that there was a response rate roughly about 67%, and the median overall survival of these patients was 17.5 months. Median duration of response had not been reached at the time of analysis. They also did an exploratory analysis of MRD, and 29% of these patients were MRD negative as well, which, you know, is really surprising to me given kind of the intensity of this drug. So it provides a better outlook to a lot of our older patients who would not have been eligible for standard therapy. The next trial is very similar. We looked at venetoclax and low-dose Aracene. And in this combination of drugs, same thing, looked at older patients who were not eligible for standard therapy. Same types of outcomes as well. We see that, for the most part, this combination demonstrated acceptable safety profile, and that remission was achieved in the majority of our patients. So we see that the overall response rate, so CR, CRI, plus a partial response, was 75%. And of those patients, CR and CRI were obtained in 70% of our patients. Of the patients who responded, the overall the overall survival had not been reached. And there was a 12-month overall survival of almost 75% in all patients. Okay, the next thing we're going to talk about is FLT3 inhibitors. And as you already know, FLT3 is a receptor tyrosine kinase. It plays a major role in our system in cell growth and proliferation. And normally, upon binding of a ligand to FLT3, it activates a cascade of downstream signaling that promotes cell growth, inhibits apoptosis, and activates differentiation. However, in a mutated FLT3 receptor, we see that it's no longer dependent on a ligand binding to it, and it's almost always on. One of the most common FLT3 mutations is ITD, or internal tandem duplication, and we find that in about 23% of patients with AML. It carries a very poor prognosis, and in fact, as Keldad mentioned earlier, patients with a high allelic ratio of FLT3 ITD, so more ITD compared to wild-type FLT3, we see that these patients, in the absence of an NPM1 mutation, they are classified by ELN 2017 in the adverse risk category. Now, midostaurin is the first FLT3 inhibitor. It's the first multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitor that targets FLT3 ITD and TKD, which is tyrosine kinase domain, another type of FLT3 mutation. Not quite as common, not quite as bad. But it's the first one approved by the FDA for human use in AML. Very well tolerated. Main thing to, as a pharmacist, I worry about, of course, is going to be your drug interaction, since it's a substrate of CYP3A4. Okay. And this drug was approved based on the RATIFY trial, where they randomized patients to standard 7+3 plus or minus midostaurin. And at the endpoint of this study was overall survival and event-free survival. And this trial demonstrated a very statistically significant improvement in both overall and event-free survival in these patients compared to the placebo arm. Okay, home stretch for me. TP53, as Keldad mentioned, is one of the bad players. This is really one that, you know, I'm really sad to see when I see it on patient's report. But TP53 is a tumor suppressor gene, and patients who have a TP53 mutation tend to be older and tend to have very complex karyotypes. Traditionally, conventional chemotherapy only provides in 4 to 6 months of survival. So there was a study done, a single arm study, a single institution, where investigators provided patients with MDS and AML with decitabine standard dose, 20 milligrams per meter squared times 10 days. And these patients, what they were surprised to find out was that patients who had unfavorable risk karyotypes had very similar outcomes or similar survival outcomes to patients who had favorable or intermediate risk AML. Unfortunately, these responses were not durable. So, you know, it's still yet to see what is the correct action when patients have a TP53 mutation. And with that, I'm done, guys. I'm going to pass this over to Kelda.
Okay, so I'm going to piggyback a little bit on what Mel was saying with these new therapies. We did a number of the clinical trials at our center, which I'm realizing now that we didn't even really say what that was. Gabe mentioned Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. We're also University of Washington and Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. And also Seattle Children's is also part of our collaboration. So let's talk just a quick second about the CPX-351, as Mel calls it, Purple Rain. Mm-hmm. We were part of that trial. We found that this was really a very well-tolerated therapy. The ECOG for eligibility for this trial was from 0 to 2, and the age range was from 60 to 75. And it'll be interesting or potentially interesting to look further into whether this, since it was so well tolerated, could be used in patients with even higher ECOGs or even age ranges outside of that 60 to 75. She also mentioned gemtuzumab, which is, as she mentioned, made a comeback in 2007. During those years when it was off the market, we opened up an expanded access trial with this and treated 44 individual patients. Most of them were adults, and a handful of them were pediatric. If anybody of you are going to ASH, I'll have a poster on this. You're welcome to come see me on Sunday evening, talking about what we used in combination with gemtuzumab, which was a wide range of therapies, high dose and low dose. We used our standard backbone of G-CLAM with it. We used FLAG-IDA with it. We did azacitidine and even gemtuzumab alone as well. So the main criteria for being able to be treated on this expanded access was to have relapsed or refractory AML, MDS, or APL. Initially, patients had to have good risk cytogenetics, since that's what was shown probably was the main benefit of gemtuzumab. And then later, once the data came out, especially in pediatric patients, that despite cytogenetic abnormalities, it could be beneficial in pediatric patients, we changed that criteria. And Pfizer and the FDA allowed us to use this despite what cytogenetic abnormalities were. Spoiler alert for the poster, which I can talk about because I think as of the 1st of November, all of that's available online now. The big takeaway is that it was well tolerated, and no one died from toxicities from the go. And the observed versus expected outcomes were really about the same. And then the third therapy you talked about was the ABT-199 venetoclax. We had it open at our center with both of the ARA-C arm and also with the azacitidine arm. And it'll be a big topic, I think, at ASH this year. It looks like there's a number of oral presentations and posters in the use of venetoclax. And eventually, maybe we'll see some use of it in the relapse refractory setting as well. As far as I know, it's been used mostly up front, but I could be wrong about that. Ask me, I guess, after ASH. And one of the things about it being low intensity, as Mel mentioned, is that we have at least two patients that I can name off the top of my head that had poor risk disease and that were older. That are still in a full CR without relapse. From a lower intensity therapy with patients with AML, that's pretty impressive. So we'll see how this all folds out.
You know, Khaled and I were talking about it yesterday. You know, I hadn't seen a lot of ABT-199 or venetoclax in AML prior to doing the research, as well as these clinical trials. A lot of it happens to be because, you know, the drug itself up till that point was not approved for AML, only in CLL and SLL. And so getting insurance approval would be very difficult just because you're going to be jumping through a lot of hoops, a lot of prior authorizations, and you're crossing your fingers that the patient has good insurance that, you know, after a PA or two that you'll be able to get it approved. So I think following ASH and all the research that's coming out of that drug and in this realm, we may be seeing some changes in the indication as well.
Great. Future directions. There was a nice talk yesterday by Drs. Park and King about CAR T cells. I won't go into too much detail. That was very well covered yesterday. Currently, we don't have a specific target for AML, at least at our center. I believe there is one center, maybe City of Hope. I should have looked that up before I came up here. That does have a CAR T cell for AML, but so far it's not been widely available. And then also there's new BiTE studies coming out by specific T cell engager. Since the gemtuzumab has shown to have value as an antibody in AML, against antibodies in AML, the BiTE has potential also to harness some polyclonal cytotoxic T cell to lyse tumor cells. There's an Amgen 330 drug that's on clinical trial right now, and the target is CD33 and CD3. And it could be potentially effective in destroying CD33-positive human AML cells. So we'll see how that goes. And just a couple other future directions that I want to mention that I didn't get up on the slides, and I didn't want to put a redo at the last second up here. But in regards to future directions, measurable residual disease, as I already mentioned, is a pretty hot topic. The use of different PCR and use of flow cytometry certainly has a role in modifying what post-remission therapy patients might get if there is MRD. At our center, we're hoping to open up a trial using gemtuzumab in the MRD setting. We also have a couple other currently open therapies for MRD. There is quite a bit of interest in personalized, individual, customized therapies for patients. There's the BEAT AML trial that's run by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and I think other centers have individual studies as well. Dr. Becker at our center has something that we call internally as pick a drug, and where she takes a sample of patients' AML cells and puts it on an assay of about 50 different anti-leukemia or anti-cancer drugs in general, and sees what therapies could potentially be good to kill off that person's leukemia presence. It's a little difficult, as Mel has mentioned, the fact of insurance clearance. So if you find a drug on that panel that might look like it could be really effective, the chance of getting that can be difficult through insurance and cost prohibitive without insurance.
Yeah. I remember one of our patients who had failed so many different lines of therapy, and the one drug that worked was Velcade, and that was not going to, the insurance absolutely would not approve it, but it was based on the assay. That one showed significant ability.
I think we'll see more of this in the future as well. There was a nice talk by Dr. Von Gunten yesterday about palliative care, and that wraps in the idea of supportive care, which has really been one of the biggest reasons we have better outcomes now than in 1973, has been supportive care, including the use of posaconazole or antifungals during times of significant myelosuppression. But there's also other things that are coming out. There's a company called NOLA, which is stands for not HLA-matched progenitor cells, that we have a clinical trial using it after intensive chemotherapy to see if we can abate some of the infectious complications after. So that's another thing that we'll see. Our center, and actually there's another six or eight centers across the U.S. that's running this trial. That's what I have for updates. Anything else?
Awesome.
You have? Just our last couple of slides. We couldn't leave without talking about APL, acute promyelocytic leukemia. It represents about 10% of new AML cases in a year. And this was pretty much a was a very high mortality rate even in the first week of starting therapy, and that has changed now with the use of ATRA, all-trans-retinoic acid, which is a vitamin A derivative, and the use of arsenic trioxide. Patients can now, especially if they're not high risk, if they have a lower white cell count under 10, can be potentially cured with non-chemotherapy agents alone. APL's hallmark is the translocation of 1517. And the biggest complication is coagulopathy and bleeding at presentation. This study was published last year using ATRA and arsenic as a superior to chemotherapy in patients with APL, and you just don't see survival curves like this in any, really most of the myeloid malignancy areas where it's right up into the 90-some percent. That's it. Thanks. We'd like to thank everyone at JADPRO. This has been really a lovely experience getting ready to do this talk, very organized. And thank you all for coming and to all of our preceptors that have taught us along the way. And the patients.
Absolutely. No, this has been a really exciting experience. I don't very often give presentations to such a large group, so our heart was pounding this for the last five months. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your attention.
I have a question. I want to thank you for your presentation, but Kelda, do you mind kind of elaborating a little bit on MRD, exactly what equates MRD? Is it like when their BCR-ABL is undetectable, or if the FLT3 mutation is now gone? Like, can you kind of go into a little bit more detail about what exactly is MRD for the patient?
Yeah, traditionally it's been use of morphology greater than 5% in the marrow. But at our center, at least, we are highly suspicious if it's basically anything. If the FLT3 is still positive, the NPM1 is still positive, CEBPA is still positive, then it's very curious that we would consider it. Our hands get a bit tied with being able to treat with that, just because so many protocols require it be greater than 5% blasts, often by morphology in the marrow. And that really limits what we can treat with. But at our center, if someone was still, you know, FLT3 positive after initial induction, that may be a consideration of really trying to push more towards a transplant or more additional high-dose therapy. No, it's a hot topic right now for sure. I wish we could almost just say anything that's there, let's, you know, make more therapy available. But we're not quite there yet with our knowledge.
Yeah, and it really is, even though I think a lot of us, we've practiced with MRD as kind of a standard of care, it's not quite fully accepted yet. So if you read the NCCN guidelines, you know, they don't recommend MRD in AML. However, if you look at ALL, you see that MRD is a crucial part of treatment.
Yeah, that's a good point. Great, any other questions?
We have a question over here. Coming right behind you. There's a microphone right behind you here.
Hey, I was just wondering if you could tell us more about that essay you said that could actually look at and tell exactly what the patient might respond to.
Dr. Becker's essay.
Oh, Dr. Becker's essay. Yeah, she has an oral presentation on this at ASH coming up next month, so I don't know how much I can really say about it, but she isolates about, I think, 5 million cells. It's what's required to take a look at the assay. She'll take it off peripheral blood if there are enough cells in the peripheral blood. Otherwise, it requires a bone marrow aspirate to do it. And it's under a protocol, so patients sign informed consent to have this done. And then she takes the sample into her lab, and within, I think it's been an average of 5 to 7 days from the sample arriving to coming up with therapies that could be potentially beneficial for the patient. And I don't know off the top of my head of the panel of 50-some different probes on her assay, how many often tend to be higher, but then she'll take a look at the ones that are in the higher ranges and see if any of those therapies are potentially viable for using for the patient. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting work. That answered enough for you?
I think there's a question.
How often are you testing the MRD, and is there a frequency or a time span after they've received the treatment? Like when the cancer recovers, do you do it immediately? Are you running on day 14 or 21 with your G-clam? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great question. So when we do the recovery marrow, which sometimes is day 28, sometimes day 35 or 40, we might give them a little more time to recover their counts, which we hope would mean, you know, recovery of blood counts, meaning a healthier marrow is coming in. Ideally, we would run whatever was positive again, and that's something our center is looking at, and actually something, a project that's on my list where I'm going through all these patients and seeing if they were NPM1 to begin with, was it retested? And it's something that is going to be, you're going to see more of a push to make sure this is done. At least we've been talking about it. But ideally, all the time there was something positive, we would recheck for it. So, and it is also, you know, sometimes patients come from a different center and they get flown in from Alaska and their marrow was done there, and they come and we confirm disease, they start therapy, and then we realize later that some of those molecular studies hadn't been done, or the fish hadn't, or, you know, certain things weren't complete. So then we're not able to really, unless there's a lot of disease burden, figure out what was there to begin with. Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, you guys. Great questions. I think that's a stretch, not a question. Awesome. Thanks, you all.
Okay, great.
It's great to be here.